Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The CDC's eviction moratorium, which kept millions of renters in their homes, expired at midnight on Saturday. But the CDC says it no longer has the authority to extend the moratorium. In late June, five conservative Supreme Court justices signaled that they would not let the White House extend the eviction ban beyond July 31st, absent further congressional authorization, according to Slate. So now Democrats are arguing over who is to blame. On CNN over the weekend, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez put the blame on conservative House Democrats.
The House and House leadership had the opportunity to vote to extend the moratorium. And there were many, and there was frankly a handful of conservative Democrats in the House that threatened to get on planes rather than hold this vote. And we have to really just call a spade a spade. We cannot, in good faith, blame the Republican Party when House Democrats have a majority. Now, there is something to be said for the fact that this court order came down on the White House a month ago, and the White House waited until the day before the House adjourned to release a statement asking on Congress to extend the moratorium. This came after weeks. I sit on the Financial Services Committee, which has jurisdiction over housing. We had, you know, the housing secretary there asking about the administration's stance. We asked the Biden administration about their stance, and they were not being really forthright about that advocacy and that request until the day before the House adjourned. And so the House was put into a needlessly difficult situation. And it's not just me saying that. Financial Services Chairwoman Maxine Waters has made that very clear as well. And so there's a couple of contributing factors here. We have governors who are also not getting this emergency rental assistance out in time, which is forcing this extension, what we would like an extension of the moratorium. The fact of the matter is that the problem is here. The House should reconvene and call this vote and extend the moratorium.
That was Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez speaking this weekend on CNN. According to the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, more than 11 million people are now behind on rent. Congress set aside nearly $50 billion in federal rent assistance to help families pay back the rent they owe, but that rollout has been very, very slow. States like New York, Illinois, and California have state eviction moratoriums in place until later this year, but many states have no protections at all. Jeffrey Hearn, director of litigation legal services of Greater Miami, told the Associated Press that August is going to be a rough month because a lot of people will be displaced from their homes. It will be at numbers we have not seen before. Yesterday, landscaper Louis Vertentes in Providence, Rhode Island, spoke with the Associated Press in eviction court.
My name is Louis Vertentes. I'm 43 years old. I'm a landscaper, and I was living in Riverside until today because they evicted me and gave me exactly 3 weeks to get out. And unfortunately, I have no place to go and nowhere else to go. I got sick and ended up being backed up by my rent because I was in the hospital for a while, and also I got backed up during the wintertime because of the pandemic and the coronavirus, and I ended up being backed up by my rent, and my landlord doesn't want to hear it, so he got me evicted. I feel lost. I feel helpless. I feel like I can't do anything, even though I work and I got a full-time job. I can't. It doesn't help. It ain't helping me right now, and nobody seems to want to help. Right now, I don't know. I have no plan. I'm screwed. Pretty much screwed. I have no plan. They gave me 3 weeks. They wanted to give me 6 days to get out. They gave me 3 weeks because I begged for it. And in 3 weeks, I have no idea where I'm going to go or what I'm going to do. I was backed up 4 months, and I ended up talking to my landlord, telling him the situation with my medical, and trying to see if he would work with me, and he didn't want to hear it. He's like, why am I going to wait for your rent when I can get somebody else moving in here? So he's throwing me out to get somebody else in so he can get his money, which I kind of agree with the guy. He needs to make his money too, but you got to work with people. Everybody's having hardships right now. Everybody needs a little bit of help from somebody.
That was landscaper Louis Vertense in Rhode Island speaking with the Associated Press while he was in eviction court. His landlord's attorney says the case is public record and it will affect his ability to rent an apartment or get credit in the future. Joining us to talk about the latest are two guests. Deborah Thorpe is Deputy Director of the National Housing Law Project, an organization whose mission is to advance housing justice for poor people and communities. She's based in San Francisco. Hi, Deborah. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much.
Great to have you. Emily Lemmerman is a research specialist with the Eviction Lab at Princeton University. Emily has monitored evictions during the pandemic. Hi, Emily. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Emily, I want to start off with you. It's just devastating to hear Louis there say that he has no idea what he's going to do. And the latest numbers tell us that millions of people will be in a similar situation in the coming weeks and months.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, I think that unless we can make sure that renters continue to be protected as rental assistance waits to get out to renters, and even with that, it's going to be a really large wave of evictions.
Deborah, what would you add? What concerns you most right now?
Sure. So we know there are normally on average about 3.7 million eviction filings per year. And according to data from Emily and her colleagues at the Eviction Lab, we're missing about 1.3 million filings, which means that absent any federal, state, or local protections, we're about to see a lot of evictions, and evictions have enormous impacts on families and communities. So we're all really bracing ourselves. We know that there are between 7 and 10 million households in this country currently delinquent in rent. We know there's a lot of money for rental assistance waiting to be distributed that hasn't been yet. And so it's, in some ways, it's really the perfect storm then with the rise of the Delta variant and coronavirus cases across the country.
Emily, what are you hearing from people across the country? We just saw a headline this morning from WDSU News. COVID-19 vaccines will be required for all New Orleans deputy constables ahead of a heavy eviction workload. And the constables are the people that go knock on doors to let people know that they are being evicted.
Yeah, so obviously, while perhaps that might be seen as some sort of good news, I think this is really hardly good news at all. Renters are still going to be displaced by those constables. And as Deborah mentioned, eviction is a really, really scarring event for families, and it causes intergenerational trauma. We know that kids who are born after their pregnant mother is evicted have lower birth weights, have families have worse mental health and other, you know, kind of worse life outcomes and in general, just trauma and heartbreak within those families. And I think, you know, regardless of the Delta variant, regardless of coronavirus, this pandemic, pandemic of evictions is a very bad situation. On top of that, recent research at the Eviction Lab has found that those living in places, zip codes within 9 American cities where there are more evictions, those are the same neighborhoods, the same people who are least likely to be vaccinated. So regardless of those constables being vaccinated, not enough people are vaccinated right now. And we know that when people are evicted in a community, that actually raises the rate of COVID-19 infection and transmission. And so really with the Delta variant, this seems like a very much a perfect storm of sort of very bad things happening.
Right. And there was another piece out of Las Vegas about how more and more people are living in their cars because they cannot afford rent. And as we said in the intro, Deborah, Congress set aside nearly $50 billion in federal rent assistance to help families pay back the rent they owe and to also help landlords. But the rollout has been so slow. What explains that?
So there's several factors that really help explain the slow rollout of this emergency rental assistance from the federal government. And, you know, it's important to note the last figure I saw was about $3 billion out of about $46 billion in those emergency rental assistance dollars have been dispersed nationwide, right? So that's about 12%. So, you know, we've learned a lot in the process, I will say. It was a really novel program. The federal government has never funded emergency rental assistance, anything, you know, close to the scale. And so a lot of local jurisdictions, state and local governments were really have been ramping up programs in real time. So the infrastructure just wasn't there in order to get the money out efficiently and effectively. And we, you know, again, we've learned a lot along the way. So initially, when the first rental assistance dollars were available, the money was going for the most part directly to landlords. And state and local programs quickly learn that that's not the most efficient way to distribute the funds. It has to be also available to the tenants themselves to directly apply. So that's something that the Treasury, who's allocated in most of the funds, has sort of, you know, changed their stance on with respect to guidance for local programs. Another really key issue is that programs learned really quickly that the money itself, the application process, had to be extremely low barrier. A number of programs very early on were requiring documentation from tenants of things like, you know, lost rent, the, you know, to show that it was COVID related, for example. And that just really wasn't, again, the best way to get the money in the hands of the people who need it most. And so now many state and local programs have really shifted and turned to these low barrier methods to verify things like, you know, what are in fact the arrears, and you know, do you have to bring your paper lease in. And so there's been a big shift around that. And then also really important with respect to the equitable distribution of these emergency rental assistance dollars is that outreach is we know now is a key component to really reach the communities who need the funding the most. So many programs now are engaging in outreach directly in those communities, you know, as Emily said, the communities that oftentimes have the lower vaccination rates are the communities that are going to be hardest hit by evictions. And so really having people go door to door in some cases to make sure that tenants know this assistance is available.
Well, we are going to spend about 10 or 15 more minutes on this topic. So if you have any questions for our guests, Deborah Thorpe, Deputy Director of the National Housing Law Project, and Emily Lemmerman, Research Specialist with the Eviction Lab at Princeton University, now would be a good time to call. If you have any questions about getting rental assistance, whether you are a rental or a renter or a landlord, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Have you had any problems making your rent or your mortgage because of COVID? How have you dealt with that? And what do you think about the eviction moratorium expiring? You can also tweet us at Your Call Radio. So, Deborah, what would you say to people who need rental assistance at this point? What can they do? What's the easiest way to go about it?
Great. So I would say two things. One, for tenants who are behind on rent, you know, we've been saying this consistently throughout the pandemic. The first thing you can do is talk to your landlord, right? I mean, I think, you know, Lewis said it best early in the call is that, you know, to some degree, landlords and tenants at this point may, you know, need to be sort of willing to meet in the middle. And so talk to your landlord. It might be that the landlord's willing to forgive some of the back rent and or enter into some type of repayment plan with you. And so first and foremost, I would say talk to your landlord. But second is there is a number of resources available to find out where the local rental assistance programs are in your community. Our partners at the National Low Income Housing Coalition have a really great resource on their website where you can look up your location. It'll tell you the contact information for the local emergency rental assistance program that's administering those funds. The CFPB also just released a similar tool in order to locate, you know, the local program. And so I think, you know, talking to your landlord, working with your landlord, and then also knowing where rental assistance is available, it's really going to be two key ways to address any rental debt you currently have.
Emily, anything to add?
Yeah, I guess all I have to add to that is also making sure that you contact a legal aid provider if that's something that, you know, if you find that you are being filed against, and making sure that to the extent that you are still being covered by California's eviction moratorium, that you can respond to any sort of legal notices or filings that you may receive.
What do you all expect? To think that people are being evicted right now with rents so incredibly high. Again, we heard from the landscaper Louis Vertentz in Rhode Island. He said he's paying $900 for a small one bedroom, and to find something, another apartment, is almost impossible. And so many people are in that position. I mean, the rents are just through the roof right now, Deborah. So what do you expect will happen in the coming weeks and months?
Well, here's one of the big issues that a lot of people don't necessarily know about evictions, is that a filing alone can end up showing up on a tenant screening report forever, right? And so in the, you know, housing tenants rights community, we sort of started beginning to refer to this as the Scarlet E. So a filing alone, so it doesn't matter what the disposition of the case, it doesn't matter that a case itself was based on rent due because of some COVID-related job loss or reduction in income, the eviction alone is going to make it less likely for you to be able to access housing in the future. Okay, so, you know, and coupled with the fact that we were already in an affordable housing crisis before the pandemic, and, you know, the impacts of that, and now we have millions of families with the lifting of all of the tenant protections, the eviction moratorium, that are going to have filings on their record. And so these are families that it's just going to be, it was already competitive, and it's going to be that much harder for families to access safe and affordable housing in their communities post-pandemic.
This is such an important point, because as we pointed out in that AP video, Louis Vertentz, the landlord attorney, said the case is now public record, which will affect his ability to rent an apartment or get credit in the future.
That is correct. You know, an eviction has lasting impacts, and, you know, really, in many ways, this is sort of the modern version of redlining, right? Because now Lewis and others in Lewis's situation who have an eviction on their record, it is that much harder with the poor credit and with the eviction that will show up in a screening report to access housing. And so Lewis and others like him are really going to be pushed out of certain communities and going to be obtaining housing with landlords that maybe don't take as good care of their property, where the rent is lower and they're much more vulnerable. And so in some ways, we're really, you know, permanently steering people who are most impacted by evictions, which is disproportionately Black and Latinx families and Black women with children in particular. We're really sort of by way of this eviction crisis, steering them into higher poverty communities. And that will have, of course, lasting impacts.
Emily, what would you add to that?
Yeah, I think one thing that we find through our research at the Eviction Lab is that when families are evicted, they usually end up having to move into more expensive housing and also substandard living conditions. And all of that is obviously associated with displacement from the community, but also substandard living conditions, which can lead to further health issues for families and children.
Can you both talk about, I'm not sure if you want to talk about this, but the politics behind all of this? Because, again, the CDC, it was a CDC eviction moratorium. It expired on Saturday night. Five conservative Supreme Court justices said they would not allow the White House to extend the ban absent further congressional authorization. This happened in late June. And so now the Democrats are all pointing fingers. Representative Cori Bush has been sleeping in front of the Capitol for the past couple of nights because she knows what it's like to be homeless. And then I played that clip from Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who put the blame on conservative House Democrats. She said, you cannot put the blame on Republicans. Sure, none of them were going to vote for this, but the Democrats control the House. And as she said, they threatened to get on planes because they didn't want to go on the record to vote against the moratorium. Deborah, do you have any comments about the politics going on here?
Sure. I mean, you know, as you said, there's a lot of finger pointing going on right now in D.C. about the expiration of the moratorium. Right. So, as you said, President Biden says he can't do anything. His hands are tied behind his back because of the Supreme Court decision with Kavanaugh being that vote saying, you know, we're not going to rule that the CDC moratorium is invalid, but don't try and extend it again, or we will likely do so. So, you know, understandably, you know, but President Biden says he can't do anything. So he turns to Congress, you know, which, by the way, a few days before the House is heading out to their home district. So it's been a really hectic few days. There's a lot of blame going on as to why this happened. Bottom line is there was a lot that all of these parties could have done to ensure the protections were in place. But right now it is up to state and local governments to act to protect their own tenants. And there's a number of actions that state and local governments can take today to lessen this, what is likely to be a huge impact on renters. And, you know, state and local governments, for example, could create or extend their own eviction moratorium, right? They can work with local courts to create pre-eviction diversion programs that hook families up with emergency rental assistance that, you know, happens in the court in real time. You know, there's other rental protections like we talked about. You can, state and local governments can prohibit those long-term effects of these eviction filings. Whatever happened on the Hill, there's a lot of finger pointing. Bottom line is there's a lot right now that state and local governments can do really target low-income renters.
So are you saying that nothing can be done at the federal level unless the House and Senate extend the eviction moratorium? Because yesterday, Congresswoman Maxine Waters tweeted, I don't buy that the CDC can't extend the moratorium, something it has already done in the past. Who's going to stop them? Who's going to penalize them? There's just seems like there's a lot of different statements being made here. Some are saying the CDC doesn't have the power, but people like Maxine Waters is tweeting that the CDC does have the power.
There are a number of courts across the country agreed with Representative Waters' interpretation and our interpretation that the CDC does in fact have the authority under the Public Health Services Act to enact its own moratorium. And frankly, the Supreme Court opinion was a bit disingenuous in the sense that Congress had in fact ratified the CDC's authority to do so in prior legislation. And the Supreme Court ruling essentially ignored that fact. The Public Health Services Act is quite broad and really does, and, you know, it does give the CDC the authority to enact its own moratorium.
Well, Representative Cori Bush is still in front of the Capitol, and she tweeted that she has been in touch with Vice President Kamala Harris. Senator Bernie Sanders stopped by to express support along with Senators Elizabeth Warren and Chuck Schumer. And it looks like this protest, I'm just looking on Twitter right now, is just growing in numbers. What are your thoughts on this, Emily, in terms of the legalities? At this point, is it just people can just look to state and local governments to take action?
I can't speak to the legal issues, but it does seem that the White House today has come out with a statement that essentially speaks to that. As Deborah mentioned, you know, there's many steps that state and local governments can take. And it seems like, at least in San Francisco, that right now, tenants can get 3 months of back rent covered and 3 months of future rent. But the sheriff is now conducting evictions there. And so it does seem like those types of interventions, whether that's changing the rules around sheriff evictions in San Francisco or that rental debt is covered there. Those are the kind of interventions that we really need to look for in order to make sure that tenants can stay in their homes.
And to be clear, I agree with Emily. I mean, there's a lot the federal government can do right now. I mean, you know, it's also important to note that the Department of Housing and Urban Development is a landlord in and of itself for about 30% of this nation's poor families. And, you know, there's a lot that HUD could do for its own tenants to protect them from eviction. So, I don't want to imply that the federal government is off the hook. There's a lot they can and should do right now to prevent this problem.
Before we end, can you give us a little more information on what's going on in California? Because over the weekend, San Francisco activists gathered at Nancy Pelosi's home to call on her to act on this. I read that California safeguards are in place until September 30th. And at that point, renters will be required to make at least 20% of their rent. But Emily, you said that people in San Francisco are right now being evicted?
Yes. So right now in San Francisco, the sheriff wasn't evicting throughout the pandemic unless there was a judgment entered that tenants were affecting other tenants' safety. However, now the sheriff has once again resumed conducting the eviction itself. So that's not related to the court case necessarily, but that's related to actually physically taking a family, a tenant's, a renter's belongings and putting them out onto the street and locking those tenants out. So yes, evictions are being carried out right now.
This is so confusing because a number of media outlets say that California renters are safe until September 30th.
Yeah, so I think that's because there's so many different steps in the eviction process. And I think that these are theoretically for eviction judgments that might have been entered in at a time before renters were protected in this way. But I think it's still, unfortunately, there's only really a patchwork of protections for renters right now.
Wow. Well, we will definitely continue to follow this. And if you have any needs for rental assistance, or if you're a landlord and need mortgage assistance, you can find links at yourcallradio.org. Emily Lemmerman is research specialist with the Eviction Lab at Princeton University. Deborah Thrope is deputy director at the National Housing Law Project, and housing advocates fear that millions of people will be evicted in the coming weeks and months. And we played a clip from one man in Rhode Island who's already been evicted. And as Emily said, people are now being evicted in San Francisco. It's so important to get this information out there. Thank you both for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Coming up after a break, we are going to talk about today's special election primary race for Ohio's 11th congressional district. 13 Democrats are on the ballot, but the front runners are Nina Turner, who has support from Bernie Sanders, and Chantel Brown, who has support from Hillary Clinton. Today's winner will almost certainly go to Washington, D.C. We'll be back after this.